Hi everyone, welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today we were supposed to be speaking with Carol Anshaw. Unfortunately, she ended up having another engagement. So instead of her this week, we're going to have an encore presentation of a great book, The Flame Alphabet by Ben Marcus. He's a maniac, and this book is about a situation in an alternative world set sometime in the near future in which children's voices become essentially lethal to their parents and every other adult. So young parents, Sam and Claire, their only means of survival is to flee from their own daughter, Esther. The rest of the book is designed in an effort to cure this disease, and in so doing, all the characters.
You're tuned to 1520 WCAT Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin.
Here's our interview.
Sam will offer
reviews
and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader. Today, we'll be talking to Ben Marcus, whose new novel, The Flame Alphabet, just debuted in January of this year. I would give you, like I usually do, a little bit of a synopsis of the theme of the novel, but it's so weird that I can't possibly even begin to do it. So, Ben, thanks so much for joining us today, and tell us what your book is about.
Thanks for having me. Sure. The Flame Alphabet is about a poisonous language that comes from children, and the book opens with the narrator, Sam, and his wife, Claire, getting increasingly sicker from their teenage daughter. They really don't want to accept this and can't quite deal with it. And the story unfolds and you learn that the language of children in general is making adults so sick that they have to make a choice. Do they stay with their children and possibly die, or do they abandon their children and live with the shame of having done that? So it's a story about a family, but also a story about a kind of plague that comes down and what that does to a family.
Well, it's funny, you know, and I've read some of the reviews that say, hey, wait, this premise is incredibly crazy. But once you get past the suspension of disbelief, the book becomes much more like I'm not going to say mainstream, but it becomes a much more readable novel because you've allowed yourself to become immersed in the actual idea of something that seems way beyond reality.
Yeah, and when I was writing it, I'll admit there were times when it started to seem much, much more realistic. I think language is really powerful in our lives, and it's easy to forget that. And in a family in particular, when you love someone, when you're close to someone, the words you say can really hurt and can really cut. And so I wanted it to feel as real as possible. The idea is far-fetched, but I think I had some blinders on for a while, and I started to believe in it myself.
Well, you know, it's really funny. I felt, as many others at the beginning, well, you know, is this going to really work? And, of course, it worked beautifully. But the funny thing was, did you read about the Tourette's plague in New York?
No.
Okay, listen to this. You're not going to believe this if you haven't heard it. So there's like 14 teenagers, mostly girls between... You did read it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought you said play.
Oh, no, plague. So you've read about the girls in New York?
Yeah, a little bit. What's the latest?
Okay, here's the thing that's like... I said, wait a minute. He's right. Marcus is right. Because what happened was there's 14 teenagers, mostly girls between the ages of 13 and 18. I think there's one 36-year-old. And, you know, they begin exhibiting tics and Tourette-like syndrome. And now there's five psychologists, including David Lichter, who's a professor of neurology at the University of Buffalo. And he says... and it's funny, they're from Leroy, which sounds almost like one of your characters. It says the Leroy residents may be unconsciously mimicking the symptoms when they see videos uploaded by sufferers on YouTube and Facebook.
Right. So there's some kind of suggestive thing at work, and they're all sympathetically ill with each other.
Yeah, and it's almost like viral in the sense of, you know, this is not a real thing. It's almost as if it's social, but it's at the same time some type of disease.
Someone sent me an email about a poetry reading in Spain recently where 37 people got sick. after the reading, and they can't account for it. But they became, you know, nauseous. And you know, I don't think it was just because the poetry reading was really bad. But, it's a very funny overlap with my book because, of course, there's a point in the book really pretty early on where you can't endure any speech at all. And that was a provocative idea to me, that you just couldn't expose yourself to any speech. What would happen, and who would we become if we can't communicate? Then what are we for? What are we supposed to do? So the book, I think, is pushing hard on all of those questions. And
it's one of the things, now this is either going to be really weird too, or else you did it on purpose. There's a main character in your book whose name is Lubov.
Yeah.
Is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah.
Okay. So did you know there's a linguistics professor at the University of Pennsylvania named William Lubov?
I did not. Someone just told me that.
Really?
Yeah.
And, you know, he presented this paper on that human language learning is outwardly bound in that children are programmed to ignore idiosyncratic dialects and acquire the more general pattern of the speech. It's so bizarre. And you know what his secretary's last name is?
What?
Forsyth.
Murphy? Forsyth. Forsyth. Oh, my gosh. See, I didn't make any of this up. I should have just published this as nonfiction.
Yeah. Oh, and who would believe it? But then, you know, we're coming close to the point where, and I was talking to someone in one of my offices today about it, and she was saying, you know, that's not so far-fetched. And
yeah,
she actually meant it with regard to her own children, unfortunately.
Yeah, I have two little kids, and they are essentially sweethearts, but I have heard from some parents that this idea of children's language being lethal is not really that removed from what they've sometimes experienced. But I think children have a kind of power over us because as parents, we're designed to protect them, and in some sense, they have to take us for granted. You know, my three-year-old doesn't understand when he jumps off the couch and does, you know, lands on my rib cage that it hurts. You know, he needs to see his dad as, healthy and hearty and sort of someone who will live forever. And you know, the pain of others isn't something that's really on the mind of children. And so some of these things seem to come from little kernels of true things I'd already observed. Well, and to me, too, though, the book goes beyond simply being some kind of criticism of children. It, really, in the end, it's children who have a little immunity to language, and they realize that the adults around them don't. So this gives them a kind of power that they're just not good at using. In the same way, almost anyone who suddenly gains power can be tempted to test it out and see what this power will get them. So the idea, it wasn't some statement that children are bad. Of course, that would be just preposterous. It's more that they have a lot of power, and if we suddenly gave them even more, the world could shift in really startling ways.
Well, look at the way Esther, when she realizes the power she has,
yeah,
she abuses
exactly.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny when there's this portion of the book in which the main protagonist ends up in this, I guess, kind of institution kind of place. And it was like some kind of, the book is, you know, very serious and at times, you know, I guess not depressing, but difficult to read in the sense, almost like the language. It's like, it's almost as if you're talking about the book itself. It's very difficult to absorb the language and not be moved by it or almost viscerally changed by it. And when this protagonist goes to the institution, it reminded me like kind of like a semi-diseased Willy Wonka.
Oh, wow. That's funny. Yeah. So he's at this place, Forsyth, trying to, he's essentially had to flee his family, and he's completely bereft and alone. And in his mind, the only thing he can do to reunite his family is to try to somehow take part in the cure for this speech fever, the language plague, and he tries to create new languages, new scripts, new alphabets, some way to communicate that won't make people sick. And he's doing it in a place where none of the other scientists can talk to each other, share research, communicate really at all. So it was interesting to write about that place because nobody can connect and people are in their isolated research rooms trying to fix this dilemma and they can't. And, so I guess Willy Wonka's factory is kind of appropriate. And do you picture Gene Wilder in the...
Because that to me is the only Willy Wonka, because the one with Johnny Depp.
Yeah, let's not even talk about that one.
No, it's horrible. No, the beginning of Willy Wonka when Gene Wilder comes out and he's all frail and then he flips over and does that, cartwheel. I love that part. That's just and so did my kids.
He's intense in that movie. He's really kind of a horrible guy in a way. I mean, he just did the manipulations of everybody and all the character tests he issues, and he seems to know in advance that he's not going to like any of the visitors who've come to the factory. Sorry, yeah. That's a little bit of a digression, but
yeah, and it came out right at the height of the kind of psychedelic era when I was, well, never mind. And so when the ship goes through that little washing machine of thing, yeah, I mean, that really freaked me out, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. Think about it. Think about you and the author. I mean, that's Roald Dahl. And there are some similarities between you and Roald Dahl.
Wow. Well, that's very flattering. I love Roald Dahl.
Think about like Uncle Oswald or something. I mean, on the surface, everything seems like kind of okay. But then you realize there's this undercurrent. It's kind of nasty.
Yeah. Well, there's some horrible, malicious characters. And in the end, you have this genius inventor who simply has created candy out of a love for candy, but it at the same time is a kind of misanthrope, which is sort of interesting. And he decides he wants to pass his business on to someone. So he has a contest to give away tickets, which is sort of odd in the first place because you'd think he'd want to maybe vet these candidates a little better.
And look what he does to him, like to Violet.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
Veruca Salt, which is one of my favorite bands too, but I mean...
Yeah, they go through. They're all punished for being selfish, right?
Right, and they're punished based on the sins that they commit, like the seven deadly sins.
Yeah, and then Charlie, of course, has got the heart of gold, so he wins the factory.
He still lied, though. He and his uncle lied.
Yeah, I know. When they first kind of go into Gene Wilder's office, at the end.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He just kind of lays into them.
Yeah.
If you remember that scene.
Yeah.
He's like, "Wrong, sir. You lied." He really,
And when he makes them all sign that contract at the beginning.
Yeah. God.
Do you realize
we need to have a whole other radio show just talking about
this. Well, I was going to say, this is going to sell absolutely zero copies of your book.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Oh, well.
That's your problem.
Yeah, that is my problem.
You started it. Oh, no, I started it.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, if you go on with the idea of weirdness, one of the things that you're most renowned for, I guess, and what makes you unique as a writer, is that you take this pseudoscience kind of base and you derive all of these interesting but implausible inventions or small work, as you call it. And if you Google small work, you come up.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, nothing else comes up. You.
Not even like someone working on little beads and necklaces and...
No, there's some programmer somewhere that calls it small work, but it's with a space between.
All right. There's some success right there.
Yeah, there is. When you Google something.
I'm number one on Google. what interested me about that is this plague comes along and language is poisonous and the doctors don't know what's going on and the scientists are in denial. I really like the idea of Sam, the narrator, the protagonist, essentially having to become an expert on this thing to try to, thinking about what I would do if something like this happened and what kind of skills I really have. We've given our lives over to various experts. We've had to. We can't learn all these trades now that we benefit from. We've all become so hyper-specialized. And so I was really interested in the kind of peril and danger and drama of somebody sort of suddenly having to kind of make up medicines and catch up with civilization now that he's no longer in touch with it. So, and of course he can't, he doesn't know what he's doing. He has some rough idea of what to try to do, but everything he does makes it worse. So I think once I removed authority figures and experts from this world, it suddenly became a lot scarier, right? There's nobody telling you what to do. There's nobody telling you what happened. But yet you're still in charge of keeping your family safe.
But you're doing it with things that can't possibly exist. If we switch over to the idea of, and also the idea that this book is, what the river runs through it is this river of this strange Reconstructionist sect of Judaism. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, sure. So in some sense, I see religion right next to science and medicine in this book. Science and medicine are really declared, they're kind of counted out very early in the book. They're just, they can't deal with it. They have no ways of alleviating this language toxicity. And the narrator and his wife practice this very private form of Judaism in the woods, and they receive religious transmissions from this strange complex radio that's always breaking. And partly what interested me is the idea of religious faith as something kept entirely secret, and that this secret that they were keeping makes them the target of the villain in the book, Murphy, you know, who wants to know what's really going on and what they're really hearing. Because if science is useless, if medicine is useless, then what's left as a source of wisdom but religion? And so they have this sort of these religious secrets to protect, but of course at the same time I think they question whether they're of any value at all. So religion ends up, I think, being just as doubted as science and medicine. But it to me made for an interesting story to have Sam have to guard this sort of religious space from this villain, Murphy.
Who absconds with it. Well, he does abscond with it, yeah. How come you gave him red hair? Because I would have too, and I know why I would have.
Really? Why would you have?
Because I don't like people with red hair.
I see. Yeah, see, I can't say that.
I know.
I can't really go on the record with that.
Either can I.
I like people with red hair. I mean, as much as I like people at all, I feel like redheads are just as viable as you know, brownheads.
Oh, wait a minute. I just realized I have a lot of friends with red hair. I didn't mean any of that.
Yeah, I know. You're going to have to call that one back.
I can edit it out.
I'm not sure. You know, he came to me that way, and he it's funny because he at a certain early draft in the book he had these children who were in the book too who were also not so pleasant, and they were also redheads, and they were just this kind of gang of angry evil redheads, sort of like seven brides for seven brothers without the brides and without the joy and happiness.
That's another one. My brother and I used to watch that movie all the time.
You know, we're not going to talk about that.
Come on.
I refuse to. It's just too personal.
Yeah, I was like 12. We were like 12 when we watched it.
That's a very upsetting movie.
It is. We're not going to talk about it, but it is, you know.
So. It's a lot darker than my book, that movie.
Yeah, because it's not supposed to be. Yours is supposed to be really dark. For example, I'll get back to selling your books. So Murphy steals the listener.
Yeah.
Tell everybody what the listener is, because it's really effing
the listener
weird.
is a kind of vague, wet, fleshy object that allows the religious radio in the synagogue to work. There's a whole apparatus in the synagogue that's out in the middle of the woods that is sort of deliberately complicated. It's frequently breaking, and it needs these certain parts. It needs to be cared for. It needs sometimes for you to wrap your naked body around it in order to make it warm up and work. And Murphy, the villain, sort of finds out that there's this key part called a listener. And each of the sort of Jewish couples who practice this religion have been bequeathed one by a certain, you know, sort of secret rabbi, it's all getting very complicated. And Mercy, kind of, you learn, becomes a kind of collector of these because he feels that if he can get them all working together, he could draw out some very powerful, possibly transformative message from the Earth that will help him solve this dilemma.
Well, the thing about the listener and all the other various semi-scientific apparatus is it's almost like, and I've done this myself when I've written, it's almost as if you took a manual on how to construct an airplane engine, and then you took the language and inserted rubber or bacteria or some, you combine the idea of machinery and electronics with this organic type of material. And of course, the listener changes all the time too.
Yeah, it's funny. I was looking somewhere online of people having an argument about what the listener was, you know. But it's nothing. It does change. I like the idea of things that feel really specific and tactile and earthy and organic, but that in fact they don't exist and they can't exist. And this is a piece of writing, and so you can kind of make it hazy if you want to. At one point, it makes him sick. Kind of nauseous to even hold this listener.
Right.
I like the idea of that like just holding something might make you feel like queasy. And I think that, you know, everything seems to impact people in a really physical way in this book. Language makes people sick, and these objects have this really great weight. And in some sense, people are vulnerable and they're hypersensitive. And it's just, I think, taking things that I've seen that are already out there and amplifying them a little bit, kind of drugging them, making them stronger, sort of just darkening them slightly so there's a little bit, they're a little bit more menacing.
Well, they are. They're very scary creations. And then there's very scary scenarios, like, once again, selling a different book, not yours, but if you go back to Dune and Baron Harkonnen, you know, when he's all wired up and he's got tubes feeding into him and there's a Spencer and he looks just, and he has pustules and all that. Doesn't that remind you of Labov at the end with, you know?
And Labov has this, no one's really ever asked me about this, but there's this whole kind of very subplot involving animals that you never really get any more information about. But at the very end, Labov is kind of sick and there's this, he's carrying this wagon with him.
It's a wooden wagon.
Yeah, it's a wooden wagon, and there's like a little cage, and Sam, the narrator, keeps thinking that maybe there's an animal inside this cage, and he hears noises inside it, and the wagon is connected. There's like a hose in the wagon and the Bob's mouth or something, right?
Yeah, it's like, you're laughing at it. It's like, what, were you drunk when you were writing this?
I was not drunk, sir. I actually have blood alcohol tests from every day that I wrote this book. I'm going to make them publicly available.
You should have put that as an appendix. That would have been interesting.
I can't have a sip of beer and do any writing. As, you know, I just want to go to sleep.
Well, that's not like a lot of writers, though, if you think about it.
It's not. It is true. I was watching some Chris Straton's videos on YouTube after he died. There's really some amazing stuff, just him talking. He's sort of this firebrand, so smart. And someone asked him what his advice was for writers. Sort of, you know, writers always have to field this question and are, in fact, the worst people to ask for advice ever. And anyway, his advice was all about somehow navigating the rocky shores of alcohol. You know, that, you know, he's known writers who essentially drank their whole lives and never wrote. You know, they were like the people who were declaring themselves as writers. And yeah, so for him, alcohol was a big thing. Alcohol is not a draw for me.
It's funny because I remember when I was taking humanities in college and I thought I would be writing the great American novel. And I said to my teacher, who had written a novel about, F. Scott Fitzgerald. I think his name was Harry Golden. In any event, I asked him, so I said, how do you go about, you know, doing this anyway? And he goes, well, if you have to ask me, you're never going to be a writer. And really floored me.
But he was your teacher.
Yeah, he was my teacher, but I mean,
I could say that to my students.
Well, you know what? I mean,
what do you, right. He's right. But you know, what's funny, that's a generational thing, though, right there, because we can't say that to our students anymore, right? Even if it's true, you sort of have to start to
answer
that.
He was really cool, because in humanities class, like, he'd ask a question, and if it was a hard question and you got it right, he'd take a silver dollar out of his pocket, and he'd take his thumb and flick it across the room and always land it right where you were.
Wow. Did he ask for it back at the end of class?
No. It was yours, once you got it. It was cool.
See, now you'd flick your silver dollar across the room and you'd hit someone and they'd sue you.
Yeah, and it's probably, it probably would be actually illegal in some way.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, so through the whole book, the last part of it kind of changes in tone and becomes more of a real kind of, oh, this is a book club book. But I don't mean it in the bad way.
It's,
well, you know.
How could that not be in a bad way?
Well, come on. I mean, most of the authors I interview, I say, you know, we're going to make this one of our book club picks. Can you imagine trying to make this a book club pick?
No. But you think the end is a gambit for the book clubs?
No. And then you'd have the reader's questions at the end.
Oh, right.
You'd have a little discussion forum thing, which I really despise.
You should have had a reader's question at the end and just one question. What the
Hey, you can't say that.
I can't. Oh, I'm sorry. What the
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, the
okay,
last...
So, yeah, the ending changes tone.
Well, okay, and that's like Alice in Wonderland, because he goes through this hole. He just falls down this hole, and he comes out the other end, and it's like Alice in Wonderland, except he's kind of going back into the real world instead of this strange world he was in, you know?
Yeah, I like that reading. That's nice. And to me, at that point in the book, I think I was just gunning as hard as I could for the sorrow of the situation. It was really no longer post-apocalyptic book, a book about language, plague, it's like all the sort of external conceits of the book. I wanted them all to kind of quiet down so the end was really about what it was for this guy to lose his family. You know, I'm really interested. I do like these fantastical conceits and the books that have a really high degree of imagination that kick them off. But I also, I think, have an equal urge to tell really very emotional stories if I can. And sometimes those two things are not seen as compatible. Right?
Well,
the fantastical literature isn't meant to necessarily be there to kind of tell, you know, what might be called stories of the heart. And I think I like the idea of this collision of something very, very domestic and sad and plain and kind of family driven alongside this outlandish, rather crazy, weird sort of world that this guy has to navigate. So the end was about turning the craziness all the way down and seeing, you know, how emotional I could really make things.
Right, and thus the book club reference. I mean, because seriously, I mean in a serious way, because at the end, you're dealing with this guy who's back where he was, and is he deluded? Is he not deluded? There's this massive heartbreak. Is someone betraying him? Is she even there? Is somebody else there or not there? Can't she ever be there? And it leaves the reader, and I ask this of everyone, of course, you know, the book leaves your hand, it's your little baby, it's your child, and you, more than any other author from the interviews I've read, you really are leaving this whole thing up to me. And it's a big responsibility.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. You know, maybe I didn't see it as ambiguous as you just declared it. Because in my mind, he really is there. He has essentially rescued his daughter, but she may be quite beyond help at this point. He's left Forsyth, but where he did learn that there were some experiments going on in order to allow people to speak very briefly. And there's a sort of moral complexity to that. And he's trying to recreate those experiments. And so I didn't really see it as, let's say, you know, super ambiguous, but maybe I didn't really nail it and make it as firm as it could be.
No, I didn't see it as super ambiguous. I saw it, as you suggested, as a great loss, one that he was trying to salvage.
Yeah.
And you question in your mind, is there any possibility that he can? And what you say is, and I wrote it down, right at the end, you wrote, what we want is almost never exempt from the impossible. And that's like, okay, is he giving me this sliver of hope?
Well, I think that very thing for me was, you know, it just probably couldn't be worse. And he's got this little reflex of denial. I think about those kinds of endings a lot. And I've recently been writing short stories where I, you know, in some sense, I think I resist an overly redemptive ending, which would be an ending that declares hope. You know, those unequivocally declares hope. Those endings don't come that naturally to me. I don't necessarily mind them in others. I just think I can only really write what comes more naturally and feels more honest for me. And so I think what I've ended up doing a little bit is having a fairly bleak ending in which the main character feels a little bit of hope, but it could equally be seen as almost a kind of terrible denial, right?
Yes.
The reader gets to see how awful it is, even if the main character does not.
No, he doesn't.
There's a little bit of room then. There's redemption, just not real redemption.
Well, since we seem like we share at least somewhat of a literary history in terms of what we've read and movies and things, have you read The Magus by John Fowles?
You know, I never have. I want to. I don't know why I haven't.
It would be interesting if you read it. I think you would. Actually, it's really cool that you would read it. Yeah, you should definitely read it. Not only because of the ending, but because there's so much magical stuff in it, like there is in yours, and you're constantly guessing as a reader. Wait a minute, did you see the movie Eyes Wide Shut?
Yeah.
Okay, it's a lot like that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I have that book, and I've always meant to read it, so I'm excited now to have a final great excuse to do so.
So the thing about the ending is also, I was thinking, all right. We got the listener, we got these flesh things, you got this guy who's wearing testicles for his head. You know, this is way out there. But then at the end I thought, okay, well, it's back to normal. But then you start saying he goes into the back and he cooks the occasional brittle lobe. Why couldn't he just cook a damn steak, for God's sake? And then he sears a cake of jam. What the hell is that?
I mean, that's my bread and butter, that stuff. I just have trouble shopping from the mall for like the stuff that's in the background of my fiction. And it's not an ideological position, but I get nervous when I have people do these kind of things that everybody does. And what I will say is I'm doing a lot better. You know, I used to really, you know, barely be able to get a character out of out of their apartment because I had to reinvent walking. So, you know, if he's cooking a brittle lobe, you know, that's okay.
No, it isn't, because you don't go home and go to the market and ask, could I have a brittle lobe? And
how do you know? You don't know me at all.
I don't know your market either.
You should see my deli. The cakes of jam for fresh searing. It's actually, I'm joking, but it's actually a really good question, and it's something I think about all the time. That sort of, all like the background stuff, it's like set design, right? Like a TV show, it's just like, we need a certain kind of lamp here and a couch in order to fulfill the picture, right?
Right.
And fiction has that too. And it is true that I sweat that stuff. And I feel like it's sometimes as a crutch, sometimes it's just more interesting to me to not take that stuff for granted and to maybe, I don't really think of it this way, but the best word would be destabilize. So that, like, you think you know where you are and what's going on and what this real world is, but some little detail suggests that you don't.
Yeah, well, you keep the reader, like, rocking back on his heels, and, you know,
I mean, would you rather he had just cooked a steak?
I don't know if it was medium rare and was seared on the outside. I don't know. I mean, no. Well, I don't know, because a brittle lobe sounded horrible to eat, and I'm thinking, I don't know. You know, I don't know. That's a really good question. I have no idea.
I mean, I've been having this discussion a lot with some well, with some editors or some writers about, in essence, it's a question of where in a story does the strangeness come from? And does it come from the objects like that, like objects you've never seen before, you can vaguely imagine, and they're a little bit weird, right? Or can you embed it more deeply so it's not about just putting strange, gleaming objects in the story, but making the situation itself strange? And, you know, arguably, I'm doing both there, but thinking ahead in some short stories I've been working on and wanting to work on, I do find myself gravitating more towards the, okay, he's cooking a steak and not a brittle lobe, and not drawing attention to that stuff, but trying to accomplish strangeness in a much, much more subtle way.
Two questions. One is kind of flippant, which if this is made into a movie, the production designer has to like bust his or her ass to figure out what the guards are wearing, what the wooden cart looks like, what the background looks like. Because the reader
has... Doesn't that just make the movie more fun to make?
Yes.
You get to reinvent the entire world.
It's like the movie Brazil.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, you know what's really cool? In the movie Brazil, remember when they opened the panel to his apartment and there's all these winding cables? It reminds
me... Oh, yeah.
It's like the yellow. It's like the yellow cable in the Jew hole.
For the Jew hole.
Yeah. You better explain that, because some people might think of that as being anti-Semitic.
It is simply the hole down which the electrical cables go, which feed the rabbi's sermons into their synagogue hut.
So and each person is like
the characters call it a Jew hole.
Yeah, and it's like everybody who has this faith has one, but they can't tell anybody else about it, and it's, you know,
right.
And you have to hide the listener too, which is kind of cool.
Straight from life.
Well, he says, you know. And this kind of bothered me at the end. He goes, I did not give up on my religion, but I think it's a pretty crappy religion.
Does he say that?
Yeah.
I remember that. Maybe in your edition.
No, I wrote that. Well, it's the marginalia. now I got to find out.
You know, what I remember is him saying, isn't religion supposed to soothe us in times like this? Because why else would we accommodate a highly irrational set of beliefs? Like he's acknowledging that religious faith is, to him anyway, irrational, which is usually admitted to being. You know, the idea is get past your urge for rationality and just simply have faith. But he's saying, why have I bent my, you know, mind around all this irrational stuff if it's not going to make me feel any better when the world is ending? Right, so I mean, I think he's wrestling with just the value of his religion a little bit, and I think he also says he hasn't abandoned his religion, but he sees no need to listen to any sermons anymore, because once you've heard them once, why repeat them? So I don't know. I think I wanted him to seem more ambivalent towards his religion.
Okay, Mr. Marcus, did you not or did you say, I did not give up on my religion? I found only that I no longer required reminders, assertions, repetitions, harangues. Just a yes or no, please.
Nope, didn't write
you
that.
You did swear.
Prove it. Prove it on the radio.
I can't, because
you could have typed that up yourself.
It's like your book. I could type it up on some kind of flesh-colored bacteria.
Well, the ebook has been pirated, so you can maybe go to one of the torrents and download it and find it.
No, you have you have your Kindle edition for $12.99.
All right. No, I did write that. I wrote that. I admit it. You got me.
I am a lawyer. I have been one for 33 years. What I was saying was, if he doesn't give up on his religion, he's holding on to that as what, his last bastion?
Well, I mean, that whole phrase quote you read, it does, I mean, it's, he's sort of saying he did and he didn't, right? He's saying he didn't give up on it, but he just didn't need to think about it or connect to it anymore. It was like this thing frozen in his past. So it's not, to me, that quote doesn't show him clinging to his faith in particular.
No, you're right, because he said, I'd heard enough for a lifetime. I found I could do without more things to misunderstand.
Exactly. See, he's saying, you know, he just misunderstood everything he'd ever heard.
But then again, Rabbi Burke, right?
Yeah.
Rabbi Burke says you're supposed to miss out. Rabbi Burke, right. That's the whole premise of the religion, is that once you understand it, you know you're wrong.
Yeah, yeah, there's that. We didn't even really get into any of that.
No. Well, so it's the thing.
But that's from Kabbalah and sort of from real early, you know, pre-pop culture Kabbalah.
So you didn't consult Madonna on this?
I did, yeah, we talked.
Was it like during the halftime of the Super Bowl or something?
We Skyped over this stuff all the time. But she, you know, this Kabbalah features this notion of religious wisdom as something that's really to be protected. It's not to be shared to a room full of people. If you have true religious knowledge, you keep it to yourself. You maybe whisper it to some other old dude on your deathbed, and then he keeps it. And so the other interesting thing is, you know, I studied some religion and some philosophy in college, but I never really understood what Kabbalah was. And the more I tried to read about it, the more it seemed that nobody did. Like, even like Kabbalah Made Easy.
I know. That's why so many Jewish people, me one of them, and some members of my family become Buddhists. Because there's so many parallels in that. There's so many parallels in Zen.
That's an interesting motive to be becoming a Buddhist. But to me, it was really attractive to essentially have built into it this system that says if you understand this, then you're assuredly wrong. Because what that's saying is understanding itself is flawed, that we're simply not built to ever really be intimate with this, and that our understanding, the very way our minds work is a decoy. And that was so compelling to me. I really felt like once I kind of tapped into that, that the whole book came together in my mind a little bit. Because it also seems so tragic, really. You know, religion wants to separate itself a little bit from mankind, and, you know, as this sort of bridge between people and the spiritual, but that just seems so severe. It sort of really, you know, and I think this does go on in Judaism. There's this sort of profound reminder of how tiny you are, how minuscule you are, how insignificant you are. I'm not really saying this as a criticism, but it's a strategy to produce awe. And we should feel awe for the fact that we're here, that there's life at all, and that we can, you know, exist and have feelings. So when I
think that's a really good way of summarizing the book, because, and now I kind of understand the juxtaposition between real well, it's all about language, real language, and this language of a world that couldn't possibly exist, yet it does, and here it is, page after page. And all right, thanks so much. I really enjoyed your book.
Okay, good luck. I really appreciate it.
Okay, likewise.
All right.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Maybe my most fun interview ever with Ben Marcus. Next week, our guest will be A.M. Holmes. Many of you may remember her from her shocking book back in the 90s, The End of Alice. I want to ask her first whether she was worried about her mother reading the book, because the subject matter is really strange. We're now going to be talking about her new novel, May We Be Forgiven, which is kind of a darkly comic story of 21st century domestic life and the possibility of personal transformation. This guy Harold Silver has spent a lifetime watching his younger brother George, who's a taller, smarter, and more successful high-flying TV executive, acquire, you know, a trophy wife, two kids, and a beautiful home in the New York suburbs. But Harry's got his own issues, and even though he's really jealous of his brother George, he finds himself, due to circumstances which I won't discuss, in charge of a lot of things that Harry had previously been in charge of. So maybe not the best explanation, but she's a great author. I'm sure you'll really enjoy our conversation with her, and I look forward to talking with her and having you here with us next week. And as always, thanks again for listening to us here on The Avid Reader.
You've been listening to the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.